Would you open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. One of the greatest disappointments of my young life took place when I was about 13 and living in Equatorial Africa. It was a Friday night, and our family was gathered together in our living room. We were watching a movie. It's something that was a big treat for us. Now, in those days, and this might be hard for some of you to believe, but in those days, there was no such thing as streaming media. There was no Netflix, Hulu, Peacock, Amazon Plus, Paramount Plus, Disney Plus, nothing plus. There was no way to watch endless hours of digital media. Instead, each family on our mission station basically had their own collection of VHS tapes. And since the country of Gabon had a tropical climate, those VHS tapes had to be kept in special cabinets, equipped with, each one had to have their own dehumidifier so that mold wouldn't start growing on the VHS tapes. I kid you not. Because once that happened, you couldn't watch them. And so each family had their own movie catalog that you could flip through and choose what movie you wanted to watch. The movies were listed by number in the catalog and organized either by genre or by alphabetical order. And so once you got the number of the movie that you wanted to watch from the catalog, you then searched through the VHS tapes in the cabinet for the corresponding number, stickered on the tape, and then you were off to the races. And if no one else was borrowing that movie already, you signed it out and you took it home and watched it. In other words, everyone's house was basically a mini Blockbuster. And if you're under 40, you won't understand that reference either, so never mind. Well, when someone arrived with a new movie from America, it was always a big deal. It was like Christmas in July, since it was always like July. It didn't matter when that new movie came. It was like Christmas in July. It was amazing. Every household wanted to borrow that new movie. Every household wanted to watch it first. And so when we heard that someone had brought a brand new movie called Back to the Future, we were all pretty excited to have our turn to watch it. Well, so picture the scene. There we were. We're enjoying that movie on a Friday night in the tropical rainforest. And it was so exciting. Danger and adventure and time travel and Michael J. Fox all in one movie. It was amazing. But then came the great disappointment. Because all of a sudden, after an hour and 17 minutes of cinematic bliss, instead of bringing the movie to a nice, satisfying conclusion, it ended with a cliffhanger. And with the three most wretched words I could ever have imagined. To be what? Continued. As I stared at that screen, I wanted to cry in disbelief because there, on our isolated mission station, run by an ancient hydroelectric system, 10 hours south of the capital city, at the end of a dirt road, cut off by a river that you had to cross by a ferry in the middle of the rainforest, I didn't have any idea if or when I would ever know the end of the story. New Testament professor Dr. Michael Kruger says this about the Old Testament, that it was a story that was incomplete. He says, if you think about the whole Old Testament narrative for a moment and the story of it, it's basically a story about God making promises. And he makes them initially to Adam and Eve, then to Abraham, and he repeats those promises to Israel. And he repeats those promises not just through Moses, he says, but through David. And what are those promises? He writes, these are those promises. I'm going to redeem a people for myself, God says. I'm going to save them. I'm going to forgive their sins. I'm going to usher in the kingdom, and I'm going to do all this through my Messiah. You wait and see, says God. I'm going to break into the world in an amazing way. I'm going to transform. I'm going to redeem. I'm going to save. It's going to happen. And then, he says, the Old Testament ends. And everyone is like, is the story going to end? New Testament scholar N.T. Wright confirms this cliffhanger vibe when he says this about the Jews who read the completed Old Testament. He says this, the great story of the Hebrew Scriptures was therefore inevitably read in this time period as a story in search of a conclusion. In Romans 8:24 and 25, Paul says this, Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. For hundreds of years, the Jews hoped. They waited with patience for the conclusion of the Old Testament story and its promises about the coming Messiah. And to this day, there are still many Jewish people who continue to wait with patience. They still haven't seen the object of their hope. But the earliest Christians, who were also Jews, they believed God did finish the story. They believed they had seen the conclusion of the story after 400 years of patient waiting, after a 400-year period of to be continued. They believed they finally had gotten to see their hope fulfilled in the arrival of Jesus. We tend to, as Christians, think of the story of Jesus as a new story, continues Dr. Michael Kruger, that it's this new story that we want to tell people. He says, but that's not how the first Christians viewed it. The first Christians, being Jews, being born within Judaism, growing up as Jews, he says, they did not see the story of Jesus as a new story. They saw the story of Jesus as the completion of an old story. In other words, what they saw happening in the work, in the life, in the ministry, in the deeds, in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, was they saw that as finishing what God had started generations before. Isn't that interesting? And as we're going to see this morning, saying it's a story that God started generations before is no exaggeration, is it? No exaggeration. This morning, we're going to rewind a bit and begin our new Christmas series I'm calling The Arrival, by looking again at a passage we studied about 2 years ago in the Gospel of Matthew. In fact, it's the very first passage we studied together, so my guess is that either many of you who are new here have never heard it, or that most of you who have heard it have likely forgotten it by this point, and so it's a great time for review anyway, all right? This gospel is named for the man it was written by, a man named Matthew. He was a publican, he was a tax gatherer, which means, to put it bluntly, that he came from one of the most despised vocations in Jewish society. You have to understand that these were bitterly hated men. These were turncoats. They were traitors because they entered the civil service of their conquerors. And not only that, they were considered thieves as well, because the more taxes that they gathered from their own people, the more they could keep on the side for themselves. Jesus himself reflected the cultural view of such men when he ranked them with the prostitutes and Gentiles and other despised sinners in places like Matthew chapter 5 and chapter 18 and chapter 21. But here is the most significant thing, that Jesus was also known as the friend of such people, right? The friend of publicans and sinners. So that when he passed by Matthew one day, hard at work, robbing his own people at the tax booth in Matthew chapter 9, verse 9, when he passed Matthew that day and said to him, "Follow me," this tax collector immediately left his old life and followed Jesus. And he didn't just follow Jesus for a little while, did he? No, this man went from despised to disciple. He's one of the 12 who went everywhere with Jesus, opening his home to Jesus, watching Jesus, listening to Jesus, learning from Jesus, obeying Jesus, imitating Jesus, eating the Last Supper with Jesus, witnessing Christ's crucifixion and death, witnessing Jesus' resurrected presence, watching Jesus ascend out of sight into heaven. This is the man who is credited with writing this book. He may have begun as a traitor and a thief, but now he's a changed man. And he begins his book, his gospel, his account of the life of Jesus like this. Look with me now at verse 1 in our text. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. What follows that introduction are three groups made up of 14 generations each. Each group spanning a significant period of Israel's history. There are three groups made up of 14 ancestors in each. There are three groups that mostly list the male ancestors of Jesus, but not exclusively. We're also going to see the names of some of the wives of these ancestors, as well as some of their siblings. And there are also three groups that don't list the don't list the male ancestors of Jesus exhaustively. In other words, it's obvious to the readers of Matthew that he deliberately leaves out some names of well-known kings at one point in order to present this genealogy in a uniquely structured way. And so for now, the question is simply this. As many people have asked for many centuries, why in the world would Matthew start his gospel like this? I mean, I've read some books on public speaking, and this probably is not the best way to do it. It's not the greatest hook to get people drawn in, at least for us. We're going to see this was a draw for the Jews. This morning we're going to look at six reasons why Matthew very purposefully begins his gospel account with a genealogy. There's an old saying that you can lead a horse to water, but what? You can't make him drink. Unless, of course, you first know how to make him very, very thirsty. And so to purposely pique the interest of his Jewish listeners, I think the first reason Matthew starts with the genealogy of Jesus is to point back to something they all cared about, to point back to the genesis of our need. What do I mean? I mean that even in his single-sentence introduction, Matthew recalls to every Jewish mind, to every Jewish person who is reading or hearing this book, an ancient problem that affects us all. He does so by beginning with these words, the book of the genealogy of Jesus. What this sentence does is immediately point back to Genesis, to the first book of the Hebrew Bible, and to the great themes it contains for the rest of the Old Testament. And this first sentence does so in two ways. First, through the construction of the Greek that literally reads, Book of Genesis of Jesus. Because that sentence itself in Matthew, where he has it positioned, is at the very beginning of the New Testament, as if to be an intentional echo of another sentence also positioned near the very beginning of the Old Testament, a sentence found in Genesis 5:1, a sentence that has the same literal translation, Book of Genesis of Adam, or as it's usually translated, this is the book of the generations of Adam. Now, there are some who consider that sentence in Genesis 5:1 as the theme of the whole Old Testament. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Take a good look. This is what you get from Adam. Now, why would that be the theme of the whole Old Testament? Well, because, says Warren Wiersbe, the Old Testament gives the history of the Adam family, and it is a sad history indeed. God created man in his own image, he writes. But man sinned, thus defiling and deforming that image. Then man brought forth children in his own likeness after his own image, Genesis 3:5. These children proved themselves to be sinners like their parents, he writes, so that no matter where you read in the Old Testament, you meet sin and sinners. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Paul teaches that all of us sinned in Adam. God holds us responsible along with him because we were in him. God chose him to be the representative of all humanity. But since he failed and sinned against God, his sin was imputed to everyone he represented, which was everyone who would come from him. And so we're all born sinners in Adam. We're not sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners. Before we ever understood the Bible, before we ever chose to obey or disobey, we were already tainted by sin. We were already marked by sin. And we only add to that sin every day with the choices we make to rebel against God and please ourselves. This is the genesis of our need. Romans 5:12 summarizes this genesis of sin and its rightful consequence in humanity with language chillingly similar to the language of a virus. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Sin was the first and greatest global pandemic, and it had a 100% mortality rate. All of this is in keeping with what we find in the testimony of the Old Testament, the book of the generations of Adam. No matter where you read there, you meet sin and sinners. And so, in the words of author David Hood, Matthew seems to be consciously tying the story of Jesus back to the very beginning of God's involvement with creation and humanity. And I think this double allusion back to the book of Genesis acts as an intentional reminder to the reader about the literal beginning of our need for someone to save us from this curse of sin and death we're all under for breaking God's law. But I think what this tying Jesus back to the beginning also does is make Matthew's opening line appear to be a hopeful introduction. In other words, it seems to be an introduction not just to Jesus, but perhaps to the theme of a whole New Testament as well. The book of the genealogy of Jesus, it says, so that even before any conclusions have been made about who this Jesus is, already the implication drawn by Matthew is that he might just have something to do with addressing our ancient human problem. In other words, there seems to be hope here. And Matthew doesn't let that guesswork hang in the air for long. Listen again to how his first sentence ends. The book of the genealogy of Jesus, and he doesn't start there. He says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. First, Matthew refers to Jesus as the Christ. Now, we've talked about this before. For many of us, we think that that's Jesus' last name, that Christ is Jesus' last name. But it's not. It's a title. Christ is the Greek word for Messiah or anointed. He's being called by Matthew Jesus the Anointed One or Jesus the Promised Messiah. It is the explicit title of the specific king the Jewish people have been waiting to come and be the savior they need from their oppressors, which, as we also say all the time, in their minds, their oppressors currently in this period are the Romans. But in reality, their oppressor is sin and death that has enslaved them and the rest of humanity with them since Genesis. That's the real oppressor that Jesus has come to deal with first. So that by giving Jesus this title, what Matthew is saying is that Jesus is the solution to the sin problem. He is the cure. He is that Messiah. What Matthew is saying to Jewish ears is that Jesus is the one you've been waiting for. How do we know that's what he's saying? How do we know? Because the second thing he does after calling him the Christ is to immediately identify him as the son of David, the son of Abraham. Suddenly, anybody reading this, anybody hearing this, suddenly their ears perk up if they're Jews. Why? Because by identifying Jesus, not just as the mysterious Christ figure the Jewish people have been waiting for, but also as a man with a real, concrete past, rooted in real historical people, suddenly Matthew grounds and legitimizes Jesus with this first shorthand announcement of his genealogy. You know, I was I'm leading a Bible study down at the Rescue Mission, and we're talking about the book of Colossians and this epistle written to the Colossians. And I think they were sort of interested until I made the connection and said, you know what army passed through Colossae on their way to a famous battle? It was the army of King Xerxes on his way to fight in the Battle of Thermopylae, right, against the movie 300. Oh, then their ears perked up. Suddenly this Bible is rooted in history. They're very interested in that. And the same thing is happening here. This person that Matthew is writing about is rooted in history. As a man accustomed to keeping meticulous records, Matthew knew that the Jews set great store by their ability to trace one's lineage. And so now he gives Jesus instant street cred by listing his ancestors. But what's noteworthy here is that Matthew doesn't just tie Jesus back to, you know, any old legitimate Jewish family, to any old Jewish ancestors. Matthew continues to pique the interest of his Jewish audience by tracing Jesus' ancestry all the way back to two of the most electrifying figures in Jewish history. Now again, the Jews loved their genealogies. Some of the reasons had to do with inherited land rights, very practical. Some of the reasons had to do with being able to prove whether they qualified for the priesthood. Some of the reasons were the same reasons that we get excited about genealogies today and we order our online DNA kits from Ancestry.com. Why? Because we enjoy finding out where we came from and whether or not we're related to anybody famous. Yeah, I think so. It's okay to be honest. And that's what's immediately electrifying for a Jew hearing or reading Matthew's introduction, because having just alluded back to the genesis of our need, to the curse of sin that has spread to all people like a virus through the failure of Adam, Matthew now connects and anchors Jesus back to the two greatest Jewish figures of hope for a cure, two unique recipients of divine blessing, Father Abraham and King David. This is the second reason Matthew starts with the genealogy, to trace the lineage of humanity's hope. See, way back in Genesis 3, after Adam and Eve sinned and became patient zero for the sin and death that has spread to us all, God issued the first promise of salvation, sometimes called the Proto-Evangelium. This was a promise that a descendant or a seed of Eve would one day come to triumph over the serpent, the devil, and by extension, over the oppression of sin and death in the world. Gareth Crossley writes that this prophecy concerning the seed, a descendant or descendants, is the other reason why genealogies and ancestral lines are given such prominence in Genesis. I mean, so yes, as Wiersbe has said, the genealogies of the Old Testament, yes, they give us the history of the Adam family, and it's a sad history indeed. Yes, it's true that no matter where you read in the Old Testament, you meet sin and sinners, but that's not all those genealogies are for. Those genealogies were not just meant to chronicle the ongoing victims of sin, they were also meant to track the hope of that first promise. And so, as we read the Old Testament, we're able to trace this promise of a coming Savior descendant. We're able to trace this lineage of humanity's hope like a scarlet thread woven down through the generations, from Adam and Eve down to Noah, from Noah eventually down to a man named Abraham, and to Abraham God promises, kings shall come from you. Genesis chapter 17. There's even the promise that in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And so to a world, I mean, you got to understand this, to a world plagued by sin, to a world suffering under the curse of sin and death for breaking God's law, David Hood writes that God sets up Abraham's family to be the place where the nation finds blessing. You've got a curse of sin and death for breaking God's law. Abraham's family is set up as a place where they will be able to find blessing. And so this is where Matthew picks up the scarlet thread of the promised Messiah in verses 2 through 6 of our text. In this first group of 14 generations, I'm not going to do as good a job as Kevin here, but Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, verse 3, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab. And Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David, the king. At last, right? At last, it's in David that this scarlet thread, that this lineage of hope finally becomes a royal lineage. God had promised Abraham that kings shall come from you, and through Jacob, God had promised that the scepter shall not depart from Judah. And now, to this descendant of Abraham and Judah, to David the king, the last generation listed at the end of that first group, to David, God again repeats a special promise of a special descendant in 2 Samuel chapter 7. This is what, speaking to King David, God says this, not in our text, but in 2 Samuel chapter 7. When your days are over, and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father. He will be my son. Listen to what Dr. Michael Kruger, who I quoted at the beginning of the sermon, listen to what he says at this point. When we look into some of the New Testament writings, he says, we can see evidence that they think they're finishing the Old Testament story. A good example of this is the Gospel of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew is the very first book in the New Testament, and as we know, it starts with a genealogy. Now, he says, you may not realize this, but the last book in the Old Testament canon in the days of Jesus was probably not Malachi. We don't know exactly for sure the order of the books in the Old Testament canon from the days of Jesus, but the best bet we can conclude is that it was probably Chronicles. Now, what's interesting about Chronicles, he says, is that guess what it starts with? A genealogy. And it starts with a genealogy about who? He says, David. And what does Matthew start with? He writes, the first book in the New Testament canon, a genealogy. And what is it about? He asks, the son of David. What you have here, he says, is the last book of the Old Testament canon and the first book of the New Testament canon linking together on what point? On what point? Namely, that Matthew views himself as writing the last chapter. And this is why Matthew goes on to trace David's offspring all the way to Jesus in verses 6 through 16. He's telling his Jewish audience that he's finishing the Old Testament story. That's what he's telling them. Now, as we said, he doesn't trace all of David's offspring, just those who were the rightful kings. For instance, King David had many sons, didn't he? He had many sons. But Matthew traces the genealogy through David's son Solomon, who succeeded him as king, rather than following the lineage, for instance, of David's oldest son Nathan. And a Jewish reader would have recognized all this as they're listening, just as they would have recognized that for this genealogy to end at Jesus, and for him to then be called the son of David and the son of Abraham, right, immediately after being given the title of Messiah, well, they would have recognized this as a clear claim by Matthew that Jesus was the offspring promised to Abraham through whom the nations would be blessed, and the offspring promised by God who would sit on David's throne forever. R.C. Sproul says, this title for Jesus, son of David, is used more by Matthew than by any other gospel writer because the Messiah was to come from the loins of the greatest king of the Old Testament. He would be the seed and lineage of David. In the words of J. Vernon McGee, the line of Abraham places Jesus in the nation and the line of David puts him on the throne. Puts him on the throne. In other words, Jesus is in the royal line of rightful kings, the line from which this promised Messiah was going to come. And Matthew has just claimed Jesus is both that Messiah and he is that king. Matthew is telling them, Jesus is the one you've been waiting for, which leads us now to the third reason Matthew starts with the genealogy of Jesus to highlight the high point of Israel's history. Looking at the structure, the unique structure of Matthew's genealogy, New Testament scholar N.T. Wright says this, as we said earlier, we talked about this, that Matthew traces Jesus' genealogy in three stages: Abraham to David, David to the exile, and the exile to Jesus, he says, with 14 generations in each. In other words, he says, there have been six sevens so far. So the first stage is 14 generations, right? 14 is made up of two sevens, right? So there's two sevens there in the second stage. There's two sevens there. The third stage, two sevens there. And so, says N.T. Wright, there have been six sevens so far, and now comes the goal, the perfection, the seventh seven. What you have to understand for the Jews hearing this or reading this genealogy arranged in this way is that a light would have gone on in their minds as they heard this because the numbers matter. The numbers matter. Being aware, first of all, that Matthew is intentionally omitting several generations in order to maintain the symmetry of 14 across these three groups or these three stages of Israel's history, the Jewish listeners almost certainly would have picked up that he was trying to communicate something deliberately symbolic. He's trying to communicate something. And I think N.T. Wright is probably onto something when he says the numbers that really matter here are all the sevens. Remember, for the Jewish person, the number seven represents perfection, the fullness of blessing, the apex of maturity, completion. Seven shows up everywhere in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Hebrew Bible. Elisha tells Naaman to wash himself seven times in the Jordan River to be healed of leprosy. God tells Joshua to have the seven priests march around Jericho seven times, blowing their trumpets on the seventh day. And just think of creation. God worked to create the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day, the day that would become the Jewish Sabbath, God rested, his work complete. And so, as another commentator has put it, three 14s is six sevens, and a sequence of six sevens points to the coming of the seventh seven, the climax of history, when the ongoing purpose of God for his people from the time of Abraham reaches its culmination. Well, what purpose might that be? Here's what I think. I think what Matthew is trying to communicate is that through Jesus, God is going to usher in a new stage, that final seventh seven, starting with a new generation of people. A new generation of people. It's as if in the Old Testament, we're looking back at every previous generation straining, struggling, working to please God in vain against the curse of sin and death. And it all looks to be a dismal failure. But then here at the dawn of the New Testament, it's as if we find at last the arrival of the answer, a different chapter, the final arrival of another seventh day, the long-awaited hope of humanity's rest. We find at last a generation that sees freedom from the penalty and power of sin through Jesus. Through Jesus. In other words, Matthew's genealogy isn't just an arrow that points backward to Jesus' ancestry. No, like the genealogy in the opening chapters of Genesis, this Genesis of Jesus is also an arrow that points forward to Jesus' spiritual progeny, to all the generations of God's people who have or who will come through him. Through him. And all this makes Jesus the high point of Israel's history. He's the one they've been waiting for. Now, quickly, when you go through this genealogy, there's so much we could talk about. There's lots of controversial stuff about the genealogy itself. We don't have time to talk about that. Some people will object and say Jesus can't be the prophesied Jewish Messiah. He can't be the rightful king. He can't be the one they've been waiting for because, as we'll read near the end of this genealogy, it only goes down to Joseph by blood. In other words, it can't be passed down to Jesus because Jesus wasn't actually Joseph's natural biological son. Well, you know, maybe you never thought of that. I guess that's a problem. So they'll say, if you want to hold on to the virgin birth, you know, if you want to insist that that really happened, they'll say, this is what you have to give up. So how can Jesus be the rightful king if Joseph wasn't his biological father? Well, he's the rightful king in this way, that in Jewish society, a stepfather, which is essentially what Joseph was to Jesus, even a stepfather still counted when it came to legal genealogical considerations. And so Jesus is able to legitimately claim legal rights to the throne of David through his stepfather Joseph, is what that means. But others will bring up another problem that they'll see. They'll bring up the curse of King Jeconiah as a way of saying Jesus can't be the rightful king of the Jews. What's that all about? Well, and we'll talk about it in a little bit. In Jeremiah 22, Jeconiah came under the curse of God. And the problem is that we can see King Jeconiah's name in the second stage of Matthew's genealogy. He's an ancestor here. So look with me at verses 6 through 11 now. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. So King Jeconiah, the last one on the list in that second stage there, he so displeased God by his wickedness that God swore his seed, his descendants, would never sit on the throne of David. And that's exactly what happened. No one after Jeconiah, all the way down to Joseph, no one ever sat on the throne. So here's the problem. How can Matthew now make the claim that Jesus is the rightful king of the Jews and should sit on the throne if he descends from a cursed king of the Jews, King Jeconiah? I think he can make that claim because, once again, though Jesus is the rightful legal heir of the throne, he wasn't a blood descendant of King Jeconiah, which brings us to the other genealogy of Jesus in the Gospels, the one found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 3. Because although there's a lot of controversy about that genealogy, what it means, what's its significance, I think we still have some good reasons to believe that that genealogy given in Luke chapter 3, which differs in many ways from this one, is actually the genealogy of Jesus through his mother Mary. And what's important is that that genealogy also traces back to King David, not through Solomon, which is where Jeconiah descends from, as we mentioned before, but instead through the oldest of David's sons, through Nathan, who was never a king. Well, what does this mean? It means if it's really Jesus' genealogy through Mary there in Luke, it means that both of his parents would actually be descendants of King David by blood, but only Joseph was a descendant of King Jeconiah by blood. This then is one solution to how God could rightly promise King David that I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood. Because in this way, through both Mary and Joseph, God fulfills all legal and prophetic obligations that would stand in the way of Matthew rightfully insisting that Jesus is the rightful king and the one they've been waiting for. Okay? And so Jesus comes at the end of the genealogy of earthly kings, but the different way his birth is announced signals the beginning of something better, something different. The start of a new kind of kingdom with a new kind of king, a heavenly king. What do I mean? Well, look with me now at the last stage of 14 generations in verses 12 through 16. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Akim, and Akim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Matan, and Matan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. Let me ask you, how is the last person in the final stage of Israel's history introduced differently? How is he introduced differently? In this way, that instead of saying, Joseph the father of Jesus, the text breaks the pattern and instead reads, Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. Why is that significant? Why is it significant? Because it's the first hint we're given in the New Testament of the virgin birth. It's the first hint we're given. In other words, in this genealogy, we're not just given the legitimate human heritage of Jesus, but the cherry on top to Matthew's claims is that we are also given the signal of his legitimate divine heritage as well. What Matthew's saying is that Jesus isn't just the son of Mary, he's also the son of God. He's the son of God. He's not just the rightful earthly king, but a heavenly king as well. Verse 17 of our text concludes this way. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to Christ, 14 generations. And again, the implied question that hangs in the air is this: what will happen next? You've got six sixes. What will happen next? Where's the 7:7. Well, if what happened before was that no matter where you read about Adam's generations, you met sin and you met sinners, if the theme of the Old Testament was this is the book of the generations of Adam, then what happens next is that the New Testament is the book of the generations of Jesus Christ, says Warren Wiersbe. In other words, through Jesus, who does all the work for us, we can be born again into the generation of Jesus, into the long-promised seventh day of rest, and be called the sons of God from now on, instead of being called the sons of Adam. We can be referred to as those who are in Christ, instead of being referred to as those who are in Adam, which brings us to the fourth reason Matthew starts with the genealogy of Jesus, and it's this: to anticipate the family he's come for. What do I mean by that? I'm told by Esther, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm told by Esther that there's all sorts of software out there now that allows a person to edit or to airbrush their faces on social media. I've heard this is true. I see nodding heads. That apparently there are, I wish I'd known about this sooner, that there are special filters on Instagram that you can use to make yourself look better, look younger, look more attractive. There are special features in the photo apps of most phones, apparently, for removing a wrinkle here and an age mark there, apparently. But of all the things, and I want you to notice this, of all the things Matthew does choose to edit for the sake of communicating hope through this genealogy, I mean, he edits some things, right? Because he's communicating a certain message. For all the things he edits, I think it's extremely significant that what Matthew does not edit or airbrush are any of the blemishes found in this genealogy. He doesn't edit any of it away. Instead, he actually does the opposite. I think he actually draws attention to the flaws in this genealogy. Sam Albury puts it this way: Matthew's genealogy includes the outcast, scandalous, and foreigner. The family Jesus comes from, he writes, anticipates the family he has come for. I love that. Who are the outcasts? Who are the scandalous and foreigners in Jesus' genealogy? Who is Albury talking about? Well, the easiest to spot, I think, are the four women that Matthew mentions, all of whom are also Gentiles. That's significant. Two were Canaanites, one was a Moabite, and the fourth was a Hittite. Those would be Tamar in verse 3, Rahab in verse 5, Ruth in verse 5, and Bathsheba in verse 6. And so the irony here is thick, right? Because for a nation that prides itself on racial purity, here are four foreign women in the most important Jewish bloodline of all. But that's not the only reason that they're scandalous. They're scandalous in some cases simply for what they reveal about the men who are supposed to be the heroes of the story. Tamar's story is scandalous because she dresses up as a prostitute and bears children by her unjust father-in-law, none other than the very important Judah, of whom God had said, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." Rahab's story is scandalous because if she's the Rahab from the book of Joshua, she'd once been a prostitute in the enemy city of Jericho before saving two of Israel's spies and defecting to the other side. Ruth's story is scandalous only because, if anything, she shines through as being more godly and more virtuous than any of the Jewish women in her story. And Bathsheba's story is scandalous, not so much because of her, but more so because of King David's actions in relation to her. You'll notice, in fact, I don't know if you ever noticed this, Bathsheba's name isn't actually given in our text, as if to distance her somewhat from the scandal. She's referred to instead as the wife of Uriah, because I think Matthew wants to be clear that the lion's share of the guilt in that story rests with none other than our beloved King David, for committing adultery with another man's wife and then for murdering that woman's husband. And Matthew doesn't airbrush any of it away. But why does he highlight them? Why give them so much attention? Was that really necessary? Why does he start with a genealogy that will reveal so much damaging dysfunction and sin in Jesus' family tree? For this fourth reason, we've said, to anticipate the family that Jesus has come to save. Because who did Jesus come to save? Remember, Jesus is the last Adam, and he came to earth to save the generations of Adam. That's us. That's us. We are the generations of Adam. We were born into the generations of Adam, and this made us sinners. But by a choice of faith, we can be born into the generation of Jesus Christ and become the children of God, says Warren Wiersbe. God had said to Abraham, "In your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." And so Albury calls these foreigners in the line of Jesus down payments of God's promise. I like that. They're down payments of God's promise because the family Jesus comes from anticipates the family he has come for. But Jesus comes now to pay all that is owed. Jesus comes now as the fulfillment of all God's gracious promises to save Jews and Gentiles alike. As 2 Corinthians 1:20 tells us, all the promises of God find their yes in him. You know, I imagine this genealogy that Matthew is writing was a great comfort to a man like Matthew. Don't you think? To a former tax collector, to a publican and sinner. I mean, is it a comfort to you? It's a comfort to me. Is it a comfort to you to be reminded that Jesus isn't ashamed of the scoundrels, of the failures, of the outcasts, of the scandalous, and of the foreigners? Isn't it a comfort to you that he isn't ashamed to call such people friends? That he isn't ashamed to walk by our tax booths, to walk by our gutters, to walk by our strip clubs and homeless shelters and call us to leave those things behind and follow him? Is it a comfort to you to be reminded that he's not ashamed to walk by your offices, to walk by your construction sites, to walk by your classrooms and computer screens, to walk by your own messed up family tree and still call you to follow him? What a comfort. Because this is who we are, and that's what he does. We're the foreigners. We're the Gentiles. We're the outcasts. We're the ones plagued by sin, the dead men walking in need of a cure. And he is the promised blessing who overthrows the curse. Which brings us now to the fifth reason. Matthew starts with the genealogy of Jesus to hint at the nature of Christ's victory over our sin. If you read this genealogy carefully, you'll notice that twice the normal formula, so-and-so, the father of so-and-so, is changed. Two times it's changed to sound instead like this: so-and-so, the father of so-and-so, and his brothers. The first time this change occurs is with the scandalized Judah in verse 2. And the second time it occurs is with the scandalized King Jeconiah in verse 11, both of whom we've already mentioned. Both of these men have been trotted out as examples of failure. But both of these men, it could be argued, are also singled out as sacrificial leaders in the end. How so? How so? Well, Judah, the sleaze who sells his brother Joseph into slavery, the sleaze who denies his daughter-in-law Tamar a husband and then sleeps with her thinking she's a prostitute, that same Judah later repents when confronted with his sin by Joseph and becomes a hero when he volunteers to sacrifice himself so that his brothers can go free. Matthew lists him in the genealogy this way: Jacob, the brother of Judah, and his brothers. Similarly, and against all odds, the evil King Jeconiah, cursed by God so that none of his blood descendants would ever be king, even he appears to humble himself in the end and surrender himself and his family up to Babylon so that Jerusalem and his people might be spared. Matthew lists him in the genealogy this way: Josiah, the father of Jeconiah, and his brothers. Now, it's possible that his brothers there is only a reference to his three literal brothers. That's possible. But it could also mean more. Could it mean, asked David Hood, could it be that Matthew interpreted both these men as sacrificial leaders, flawed heroes who pointed to a descendant who would lay down his life for his brothers? Perhaps through their self-sacrificial acts, These flawed characters point us to the greater sacrifice of Jesus, who became a servant and laid down his life that others might go free. And I think they do point to Jesus. I think they do, because this is the good news about Jesus and what he did in his life and death and resurrection to make sure that even the vilest offender could be made a new creation, could experience a new generation, could be born again into the family of God. This is what Jesus did. He sacrificed himself that others might go free. The gospel, the good news, is that Jesus came to be the last Adam, to be your new representative, and that he lived the perfectly obedient life God demands of you, the life you could never live, having already been cursed in Adam for breaking God's law, the life you could never live as one who was a prisoner of sin before you were ever born, the life you could never live as one who is doomed to keep breaking God's law as a sinner until death and the justice of God came calling. But having lived that perfect life of obedience for you as your new representative, the gospel, the good news, is also that Jesus imputed that perfectly righteous life to you and then dealt with your record of sin, past, present, and future, by taking it upon himself and dying in your place for it on a cross. And you can rest in assurance that it's all paid for, that your sins are forgiven, if your trust is in Jesus and his finished work. You can rest because God raised Jesus back to life, among other things, as proof to you that he has accepted the work of Jesus on your behalf. On your behalf. Friends, Jesus is the one you've been waiting for. He's the one you've been waiting for. This brings us at last to the sixth and final reason Matthew started with the genealogy of Jesus. And it's this: to remind us of the future. To remind us of the future. Every year for Advent, it's traditional for this genealogy that we've just read to be read aloud in churches all over the world. Why is that? Why is that? Because it's a reminder. It's a reminder that even though God's people had to wait a long time for their Messiah and true King to come, that still, he eventually did. And it's a reminder that even though the wait has also been long for us, that it's not in vain. We too can wait in hope, knowing that our Savior, knowing that our King is still coming, and that for his people, for the generation of Jesus Christ, that second coming, that second arrival, will be even better than the first.